Welcome to the Liberty Education Interview Series. Today we're going to be talking to Kimberly Strassel, who is a longtime member of the Wall Street Journal Editorial Board and a 2014 Bradley Prize recipient. Kimberly is also a regular contributor to Sunday political shows, including CBS's Face the Nation, NBC's Meet the Press, and Fox News Sunday, as well as the author of two fantastic books, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech, and the recently released New York Times bestseller, Resistance at All Costs. Kimberly, thank you for joining us today.
It is great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Democrats and never-Trumpers insist that Donald Trump is a threat to American democracy and is destroying our values and institutions, but you believe just the opposite, as I understand it. They are the ones who are undermining America's foundations, and that their reaction to Donald Trump will prove to be far more damaging to the United States long-term than anything Trump has done while in office. So, Kim, why don't you start by elaborating on his point of view?
Yeah, that's the real theme and takeaway of the book, which is that, as you just laid out, this has been the theme for 3 years now, that Donald Trump is a wrecking ball, that he's undermining democracy. And I make a couple of points. I have a chapter in the book that points out that if you just step back and you look at what Donald Trump has done in terms of policy and how his departments have been run, you cannot make a case that they are in any way law-breaking. And in fact, they have been pretty good about following all of the rules, and they've been especially good by comparison to the prior administration that ruled by executive fiat, et cetera. I think that you also step back, and this is the other part of the book, what you can say is that the hatred of Donald Trump and the resistance mentality has led them to believe that they are allowed to take any action in order to remove him, and that is a recipe for excessiveness. And so we've seen it, whether it be in the FBI and Department of Justice's actions against the Trump campaign, whether it be the actions of justices who keep issuing nationwide injunctions, whether it be the crazy Kavanaugh hearings we saw, or whether it be the impeachment proceedings we're watching now. These are all truly norm-breaking in terms of American institutions, and they threaten to do a lot of long-term damage to the country.
Kim, who exactly is the resistance? So our listeners, you know, there's no doubt in their mind who you're talking about. Does it include members of the deep state, members of the White House staff? Who are these people?
So I categorize them more in terms of their mentality. And, you know, a funny story here, when the publishers first came to me about doing this book, they wanted the subtitle to be How Trump Critics Are Breaking America. And I pushed back on that because I'm an occasional Trump critic. I think all thinking people, when they look at presidencies, there are some things they like, some things that they don't. It's our job to actually look at elected officials through a critical lens. But the resistance, in my mind, are the haters. And these are the people who, from the moment Donald Trump was elected, they viewed him as an illegitimate president, as an occupying force in the White House, and that they therefore are entitled to take all of these norm-breaking actions. And they range, in terms of the people and who that have that attitude, they range to members of the deep state, as you said, the bureaucracy, to the former, I would argue, the former head of the FBI, to Democratic members of Congress, to millions of Americans out there and activist groups.
Kimberly, explain how the Trump resistance differs from those who are on the losing side in past presidential elections, because there are always going to be people unhappy when the guy or woman they voted for loses. How are these Trump's resistance people different?
Yeah, I think this is a very big, scary change. Is it, as you just said, whenever you have an election, someone's going to be the loser. That is the nature of political contests. And in the past, what we've had is the losing party would step back, lick their wounds, do an autopsy over what they did wrong, and then come back with a new message, something that they tried to use to resonate with the American public and gain power again. The Democrats didn't do that after 2016. Their attitude was instead, we don't like this result, and so we're going to take whatever actions we can to overturn this result. And their first effort was to follow on the Russia-Trump collusion hoax, hoping to gin up something that would justify an impeachment. They bombed out on that. We now see them doing an impeachment on this Ukrainian whistleblower question. We just had first hearings this week, but it's not proving any more persuasive, at least not to Trump voters in any way, that this is a legitimate reason to impeach the president. So we're seeing all these actions designed to overturn the results of the election. And that's a worrisome thing because, as you know and I know, we both looked at politics for a long time. When you lower the bar to that level, it tends to just keep going lower in Washington. And we're headed toward a situation where both sides might feel that that's an appropriate response to losing an election.
Do you think it's possible that, I've reflected on this many times, that these people really, deep down in their heart of hearts, they hate the people who elected Trump even more than they hate Trump himself?
I think that that is something that has definitely been revealed with the election of Donald Trump. And look, we've always known that there was a liberal elite out there, especially in the media, certain members of the Democratic Party. They like to claim that they are of the people, but in fact, their attitude is if you don't hold the views we hold, then you are somehow morally deficient. You know, we've seen different Democratic leaders express that in different terms, whether it's Barack Obama complaining that conservatives cling to their guns and their religion, whether it's Hillary Clinton casting all Trump supporters as deplorables. But when Donald Trump was elected, you saw that, I think, that disdain bubble over. And now the press and Democrats don't even try to hide it. You know, the regular jokes about people who show up to Trump campaign rallies, the regular jokes about the ignorant people, how could they possibly want to vote for this person? That is not a way to endear voters to your party, but I think they're beyond caring at this point.
In this vein, don't you find it remarkable that Democrats consistently accuse Trump and Republicans of doing precisely whatever it is that they themselves are doing? I mean, they're masters of projection.
It's remarkable. And, you know, when I go out and I talk to Americans and they're angry about what they see happening here, a lot of it comes down to what you just said, is that they increasingly believe that Washington operates under a total double standard, right? So there's one set of rules for Republicans and a completely different set of rules for Democrats, and it's the media and Democrats who set all those rules. So, you know, look at right now what's happening with this Ukraine impeachment inquiry, because it's a perfect example of what you just described. We are being told that the fact that Donald Trump mentioned Joe Biden's name on a telephone call, or when he didn't even bring it up, but the fact that this was brought up, it somehow rises to the level of a high crime or a misdemeanor. And the very people who are saying this are people who spent 3 years saying it was perfectly fine that the Hillary Clinton campaign funneled Russian disinformation about Donald Trump to the FBI, which ended up being used as a basis for surveillance warrants against Trump campaign people. I mean, you can't hold both of these things, reasonable people can't hold both of these things in their head at the same time. But Democrats, they want to forget now about that past 3 years and all of their actions and suggest that this is in a different category. It's not. And Americans are getting really sick of that, whether it's the fact that so many Democratic or former leaders aren't being held accountable for their actions. It's a very frustrating situation for a lot of people.
I'll tell you, it's right out of George Orwell's 1984. It's hard to believe that it's actually happening in America.
I think you make a really, really important point, Robert, which is that let's not think either, too, that all of this hatred is driven solely by dislike for Donald Trump. Okay, I mean, I think a lot of it is, but it's also the culmination of hatred for years by these elites for any conservative policy. And the fact that Donald Trump has been more aggressive about instituting those, I think, has been an additional reason why you've seen this blowback against him.
You know, I thought one of the best points you made in your book, Kim, is that Never Trumpers originally were concerned that Trump would destroy conservatism, but now the resistance hates him for embracing conservative policies. Don't you think this underscores the fact that many, if not most, establishment conservatives are not true conservatives at all?
Well, I don't think you can talk about the resistance without looking back at that history, right? Because that was the beginning of the resistance. It was the Never Trumper movement. And you, we call it that now. But remember, even before that, it was simply a lot of conservatives who, I think, and understandably, had a lot of fear about what a Donald Trump presidency would mean, but on the basis of their conservative beliefs, right? So, you know, we now have had 3 years to watch Donald Trump govern. And throughout his campaign, he gave a lot more explanation of what he would do, including, for instance, putting out that list of possible Supreme Court nominations. And he did a lot of things to allay the concerns of conservatives out there. But in the very beginning, what a lot of conservatives saw was a guy who, up until not that many years before, had been a Democrat and a New York sort of liberal in some ways. And they were very concerned about what this would mean in terms of tax policy and spending and foreign policy, et cetera. As you got closer to the convention and Donald Trump was clearly going to win the nomination, people began to rally around him, and then you ended up having this kind of core of Republicans, these Never Trumpers, who still continued to resist. And I, you know, my frustration sometimes with that group of people is not that they don't like Donald Trump. Everyone's allowed to make their own decision on the presidency, but they've been willing, I think, to kind of give up on some of those conservative values simply because they haven't been able to figure a way to both applaud the president for doing them and reconcile that with the fact that they want to be opposed to everything he does.
Some years ago, Michael Savage wrote a book you probably remember. I think it was titled Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. And I think a lot of people believe that referring to leftists as mentally ill is meant to be tongue-in-cheek, but speaking for myself, and I write about this a lot, I take it literally. They're clearly obsessed to the point where I think a lot of them, maybe a majority of them, have a serious psychological disorder. My question to you is, do you believe those on the radical left will ever be willing to have meaningful discussions with people who believe things like man-made climate change is a scam, or the Second Amendment is a sacred right, or abortion is a crime? Or is their refusal to discuss anything they disagree with going to continue in perpetuity?
Yeah, it's a very concerning shift, too, in politics, because, as you said, look, we've always had disagreements and policies, and what we tried to do is come together, have civil debate, and find somewhere that people can meet in the middle to in a way that will help the country. And what you have seen happen, I think, on the radical left is it isn't just their unwillingness to discuss these things anymore, but their decision to label anyone who disagrees with them as morally deficient or somehow not worthy of being involved in the political debate. And, you know, that's just a very scary thing because, you know, no one group in the country gets to decide what is morally acceptable or not. We're seeing this right now, for instance, the name calling. You know, everyone in the Republican Party is now supposedly a racist. And they've so misused that word and so watered it down to that it's now meaningless. And this, by the way, supposedly if you are racist, then you're not allowed to engage in any discussion. This is the tactic they use now. But the problem, I think, for them is that they're alienating themselves from huge swaths of the American country that – you know, this is now kind of some of the ideas that we're seeing reflected in the top candidates of the, you know, Democratic primary for the presidency. And I think that Democrats could have a very hard time with that, connecting with average voters if that's going to be their approach.
Yeah, I like what Gavin Newsom, that paragon of virtue, governor of California, said recently when Trump was pining on the fires situation in California, and he said, anyone who doesn't believe in climate change has no right to give their opinion on this. Very similar to exactly, actually, what you were saying.
And we see that happening all over the place on every topic.
Kimberly, as someone who attended Princeton before things went totally off the rails at American universities, are you as concerned as I am about the brainwashing of college students by radical left professors and their resulting lack of knowledge in such areas as just basic things like the Constitution, history, economics, and, of course, liberty itself?
Yeah, when I go out and I speak with Americans and they say, what do you think the most pressing problem is? That is my number one answer, is higher education. You know, I was just out, as a matter of fact, I was given a speech at Hillsdale College on the rise of socialism again among so many young people. And, you know, that's a disturbing thing, because that suggests that there are literally hundreds of thousands of younger Americans, when they say that they have support for socialism, that they know nothing about history and the extraordinary damage that socialism and the toll on human lives that it has left in pretty much every place that fully embraced it. And that's a failure of education, higher education. It's a failure of the hiring that they are doing at these different universities, where they are bringing in professors that only teach a very liberal approach to everything. It's a failure too of these universities for squelching the other side of the debate and, you know, opposing programs that are supported by free market groups, et cetera. They want these kids to be in a liberal mind bubble, but it could have very damaging consequences, again, for policies in the future of this country.
And I think it was Alexander Gramsci, I believe his name was, the father of Italian communism, who referred to it as the long march of communism through all the institutions, and starting, of course, with, well, now it's in grade school up and through colleges, and let's face it, they've got control now. By the way, I heard your speech at Hillsdale College, and I thought it was fantastic.
Oh, thank you. It was fun. It's a great school out there. By the way, those kids are fortunate. They get a quality education where they get to hear all sides of the debate, and they learn a lot about history and the founding and the Constitution. We need to make that more of a model at our higher institutions.
Okay, let's shift gears and talk a bit about the Schiff impeachment inquiry, for lack of a better way of phrasing it. What do you say to the average person who simply doesn't understand why Adam Schiff is allowed to unilaterally create an investigative body with his own rules that in effect don't allow President Trump to defend itself? I think people are just perplexed more than anything how this can even happen in America. I mean, it really is something that Joe Stalin would be proud of, I'm sure.
Well, I think to answer that question, I mean, we first have to look at why they're doing this. And my argument for why they're behaving in this way, which is utterly inappropriate, by the way, this is not the way we're meant to treat one of the most awesome powers provided in the Constitution, which is the impeachment tool. But the reason they're doing this is because they learned something from their Robert Mueller hearings, from their 2 years of the Trump-Russia collusion hoax, which is that if you outsource this and you make everything public and there's no there, then you are going to lose. You're not going to come out of it having convinced the public that there is any reason to act. And so what they've decided to do this time is to control the narrative by doing things in secret, by not allowing cross-examination, by not calling certain witnesses, by leaking out choice things and getting the press to publish their side or their kind of preferred narrative of how this works, and not giving Americans access to any of the other facts that might provide a fuller picture. But I think their decision in doing that has boomeranged, because, as you said, average Americans are looking at this and saying, this is not how we do democracy in the United States, that if you're going to go down the road of taking such a monumental step of voting to impeach the president with an eye to removing him from office and overturning an election, then you need to do this in a fair and open and even-handed manner, and that is certainly not what has happened.
Right, and what's your quick take on how things have gone the first day and a half?
So I'll give you a little preview. I just finished writing my column for the week, and you know I'm making the argument that Democrats, the big takeaway from Wednesday's hearing is that Democrats have already failed at impeachment, and here's why: because you know the measure of success for impeachment is not whether you hold a vote and you vote to impeach the president. It's whether or not you convince a bipartisan, significant majority of the country that you have taken this step on valid grounds, that the president truly has committed a high crime or a misdemeanor so grave as to deserve to remove him from office and, again, overturn that election. you know, look at what happened at Wednesday's hearing. You know, we got a kind of rehash of what had already come out. These were their two star witnesses. There was no real new information. And, it, you know, in addition, I think a lot of people who sat through it, they sat through 5.5 hours of mind-numbing explanation of U.S.-Ukrainian foreign policy, but they also saw Republicans making the points that you've been making about the unfairness of the process, and just making the singular point that, look, Ukraine got its aid, and there was no investigation into Hunter or Joe Biden. So where is the supposed underlying crime here? And if they can't make it that kind of opinion on their that impression on their first day of hearings with their two best witnesses, I don't see much of a way that they're going to move minds going forward. And right now, if we look at the polls, all we've seen in reality is a hardening of positions. Democrats overwhelmingly in favor of impeachment, Republicans overwhelmingly opposed, and a majority of independents who are still opposed as well. And that needle has not moved throughout all of these impeachment, secret impeachment proceedings, and I just don't see how they move it with the public ones to come.
Well, maybe I'm just biased, but if I didn't know any better, I would have thought those two witnesses were in cahoots with Trump, because I couldn't believe that they actually put two people like that out there, because the things they were saying basically made the whole thing ridiculous. I mean, it just, to me, it was exculpatory what they said. So it, given the one witness after another seems to be undermining Democrats' claim that Trump's guilty of a quid pro quo or whatever else they think it is, do you think the Dems will actually go through with a vote to impeach? That's a big question right now. I would not want to be Nancy Pelosi. I'm sure she's drinking a lot of extra Chardonnay these days. Secondly, how many red state Democrats do you think would actually vote to convict the president if it got that far?
Yeah, I don't see any way at this point that they don't hold a vote, okay? Because I fundamentally believe that the only reason Nancy Pelosi agreed to do this in the end, it was not because she believes it, not even because she necessarily thinks it's good politics, but because she was facing a mutiny from the entire left wing of her party. And there were a lot of fears that if they did not go about doing impeachment, that those base activist voters would be demoralized and not come out and vote in next year's 2020 election. So this to me is a base motivator. This is what they were doing. They're basically fulfilling a campaign promise that they would go through with impeachment. So those heads would explode if she didn't hold an ultimate vote. But it is going to put her red state Democrats in a very tough position. You know, as it were, she lost two of them even for the vote to proceed to an impeachment inquiry. And if they don't do a better job of convincing people, you know, this could come back and hurt them in their districts. But again, I don't see any way that they get out of holding that vote now that they've set this freight train in motion.
Just a couple more questions on some other topics. First, the impending IG report, Michael Horowitz, and the Barr-Durham investigations. Do you believe the key players in the coup to overturn the 2016 election results will ever be prosecuted? And I'm talking about people like Brennan Clapper, Comey, McCabe, people everybody's familiar with. And then you have lower-profile folks like Bruce and Nellie Orr and Sally Yates and Samantha Power and Loretta Lynch, who I get the uneasy feeling will just kind of sneak out of the room like our friend, Lois Lerner, with the IRS scandal, and nobody ever seems to get punished. How do you think this is all going to go down as far as consequences?
Yeah, so here's what I like to say. My best hope for this is that we get all of the information and that people are held accountable, okay? And that's a different question from prosecution. And by the way, people always kind of wrinkle up their eyes at me when I say this. They get mad, and I understand why, because folks are mad out there. And again, it goes back to that double standard. They feel as though senior officials are sort of, they're not held to account. They're not held to the same prosecutorial standard as average Americans. And I get that anger. The one thing I like to remind people, though, is that, you know, guys like Jim Comey, he was a lawyer his whole life, and he was very clever and he's very slick. And whether or not they end up finding something that was actually a crime committed, is that's a harder question. Like I look at, you may have seen this, you know, the Department of Justice, after the last IG report, they did recommend Comey potentially for charges for leaking what amounted to classified information as part of one of these memos that he gave to the press. And the Department of Justice declined to prosecute because it turns out that Jim Comey was very smart, and he made sure that none of those memos went through an official classification process before he was fired. And so he could therefore say, well, it didn't have a classified stamp on it when I gave it to my buddy and they gave it to the press. It would have been hard to prove that in court. So I'm only saying this by way of saying I want everyone to know what happened, and if people broke the rules, I want them to be called out on that, and if they broke the law, I want them to be prosecuted for it. And I am hopeful that both in the Inspector General and the Durham reports are going to get most of the way to that.
Two last items here. Do you believe the resistance has overplayed its hand and that Democrats will pay a price in the 2020 election?
I think that in part depends on how they handle impeachment. I think that there's going to be a lot of Americans, especially in some swing districts, that are going to view this as the latest of a kind of outrageous conduct, and they could come out and sort of certainly register their disapproval on that. Now, that being said, I will say that the Democratic approach of pursuing this and motivating their base has helped them in some of these special elections as well. Their base is motivated to come out too. So I think that a lot of this is going to come down to who their standard bearer is in the end in terms of the Democratic primary nomination. I think someone like an Elizabeth Warren is going to have a very hard time connecting with a lot of average voters. But I think it's also going to come down to, you know, the White House and Donald Trump still also have some work to do about reminding Americans of the accomplishments they've had in office, and also coming up with a second term agenda, which is something we're still waiting for, too.
Now, as you mentioned that, let's close on a topic that is front and center today, and that's the Democratic presidential field. I'm sure everyone would love to hear what you think of the current field of Democratic candidates and who you think has the best chance of winning the party's nomination.
Well, overall, it is remarkable how far left the Democratic Party has shifted in just the past 4 or 5 years. I mean, I remember in the last presidential race, you know, Barack Obama left office bragging about the amount of fracking that had happened and oil and prices and money that had come into the government through leases, et cetera. We now have a Democratic Party that basically pretty much says they don't want to, they're going to ban fossil fuels, ban fracking, and get rid of all of the jobs associated with most of the current energy sector in the United States. This is a remarkable thing to say, especially in light of the fact that if you go and you look at Hillary Clinton's book that she wrote after she lost this last time in 2016, she points out that she thinks one of her bigger mistakes was that one speech she gave in a town hall in which she promised that she was going to shut down a lot of coal jobs. You now have a Democratic Party bragging that this is what they're going to do and more. So very far to the left. I think that if you get certain people like a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren, that could be very harmful to Democratic prospects for winning the presidency. I think their other problem, too, is that if you look at the guy who probably would do the best with the broadest array of Democratic voters, it's Joe Biden. And yet here the Democrats have decided to choose as their basis for an impeachment the one subject area that also implicates their front runner in terms of his actions in the Ukraine and his son. So, you know, they've left a mark on him. And how does Joe Biden, if he gets the nomination, prosecute this question against Donald Trump, given that every time it comes up, Donald Trump's going to point out his whole connection to the Ukraine? So I think they've made themselves a bit of a mess here. Now, that all being said, like I said, there's a lot of appetite out there among Democrats to gain the White House, and the Republicans are going to have to really run a good, steady race if they want to come out on top, too.
Absolutely agreed. Kimberly, terrific interview. These have been great insights. And I thank you for laying everything out in a way that is so logical and so easy to understand. And I also wish you continued success with your great new book, Resistance at All Costs. And we look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to it as well.